Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore. I'm Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by three lovely guests. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning.
To my right is Trevor Wild, Managing Principal at Wild Wealth Management Group. Trevor, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Mike Brown, Arizona President of Washington Federal Bank. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Tim Mosier, partner at Quarles & Brady in Phoenix.
Thank you, Adrian.
Thanks for being here. Good morning. Trevor, start us off here. Tell us a little bit about Wild Wealth Management Group. How are you serving folks and what's your role?
Thank you. Wild Wealth Management Group's been here in the Valley for the past 30 years. My dad started our practice about 30 years ago, primarily helping people through education in retirement planning, estate planning, and really just financial preparedness. And over the last, I would say, 15, 20 years, as we've evolved the organization, we've really encapsulated specific disciplines into our practice, such as tax, legal, financial planning, investment management, and insurance. But our core really is helping the people of Arizona, primarily and ranging from retirement planning to college planning and really everything in between as it relates to their financial lives.
Now, how much of your work is making up for gaps in everybody's basic education? I mean, we didn't learn most of what you deal with
right
in school.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, our focus in our practice is really educating clients. And one of the things that my dad taught me long ago, and it's a principle that we still believe today, is the more educated our clients are, the better we'll be together with them and the better decisions they'll make. And the difference is in the traditional education of learning about finances, there's so much that's not taught in school, whether it be about, you know, tax savings in retirement plans, to even simple concepts like compound interest are really not focused on enough in traditional education.
Now, you've got branches across Arizona.
Correct.
Give us a sense of the scope and the scale of your operation, assets under management, et cetera.
Sure.
What would help us wrap our heads around what you're up to?
Sure, yeah. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we consider ourselves to be a family office. You know, our goals are not to become a behemoth, but really stay small and focused on the people of Arizona. We have a branch in Payson, Arizona, a branch in Glendale, a branch in Tempe, and then our primary offices are in Scottsdale. We have about 7 different wealth advisors that help support our clients and about 20 administrative support professionals and team members that help support our practice. And we're overseeing about $700 million in assets under management.
Fantastic. And how did you personally get started in this? Take us back to the moment when, you know, like all of us were, you're facing some life choices, and here you are now.
Yeah, it was, as I mentioned, you know, my dad started our practice when I was in high school. And so I remember Sunday afternoons, you know, helping him prepare for educational forums of the week and things like that were just something that we grew up with. I ended up down in Tucson, played football for the University of Arizona. And when that came to an end point, my senior year, when I realized, okay, my athletic career was over, the interest in financial planning and really helping people was a natural transition. That's really what drove me back to talk to really get into the industry, and didn't initially partner with my dad, but after a couple years working for a larger firm, we decided to partner up, and the rest is history, as they say.
And when was that? When did you all get started together?
2002 is when we formed our partnership.
Yeah. So that's a rocky moment in terms of financial services. I mean, were people at that moment when you came on board still reeling from some losses from the previous year? Or what was the situation and how has things changed between then? We've had another, obviously, major hit. Tell us what you've seen between 2002 and today. What are folks dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's so 18 years in the business. I actually started in 2000, right before the bubble burst, what they now refer to as the tech pop or burst. And a lot of really good life lessons going through that, you know, coming in right before that pop, seeing the markets decline by 40 or 50% from 2000 to 2002, seeing the recovery and the amazing growth that we saw, especially here in the Valley in real estate from 2002 to 2008. And then again, even a more severe recession and impact, especially here in the Valley with as much real estate exposure that was here, another significant downturn, and then experiencing the last 8 or 9 years of strong markets. The one piece that probably the biggest lesson that I've learned through all of this is the importance of planning. You know, and as an investor, far too many people, I think, get caught up in the good times or caught up in the bad times, as we're, you know, kind of been dealing with the last few months, and lose sight of the long term. And so in our practice, what we really try to prepare clients for and work towards is developing a plan and a portfolio to weather either side of the market, because we know they're both going to exist. We're going to have bad times, we're going to have good times, and it's incredibly hard, it's impossible to time them. But being prepared and helping people be prepared for what that could look like or will look like is an important part of what we do.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned real estate exposure here in Arizona and the unique effect that that might have on someone's portfolio management and some of the concerns you have on their behalf. Are there other interesting dynamics, or is there something more you'd like to talk about with regard to real estate?
Well, you know, I mean, just specifically being here, and we have clients throughout the country, but 90% of our clients are here in Arizona. And when, you know, in the last downturn in 2008, because of the financial crisis and how it impacted the real estate market, our, you know, the normal everyday investor was far more impacted, I would say, than we saw in 2000, 2002, and probably more so than we will see in the next recession, whenever that does come. But yeah, again, it just comes back to developing a plan, you know. And what we did see in 2008, or in the years leading into 2008, because real estate had done so well for so long, we had a lot of traditional investors that started to get swayed and pulled into investing in real estate properties and rental properties that it was foreign to them. But their emotions, you know, the fear of missing out, you might say, pulled them into all of a sudden becoming real estate investors, when really they maybe had no business being there to begin with. And so, you know, much like the stock market, you go through a run like we've had the last 8 or 9 years, and there's conservative investors over the last few years who have gotten pulled into having more equity exposure than maybe they had any business, you know, being, because they lost, either didn't have a long-term plan or just lost sight of what their ultimate goals were.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's an interesting challenge. On the one hand, you want to do right by people. On the other hand, you want to do right by the business. Of course, you want to do both together. And sometimes that means trying to get their eyes opened so that your interests are in fact aligned and that you're able to protect their assets. What are some of the most common issues or challenges you're seeing, maybe here even in the beginning of the year, where, you know, we got another tax season rolling around, predictably? What are people asking? What are people dealing with? What sorts of things are you and your team fielding?
Well, probably like you would suspect, you know, we're coming out of a correction from the end of September through the end of December that really expanded in December. It's interesting because in historical terms, what we've been through is really not that out of line for what a correction looks like. We saw most of the general markets down somewhere between 15 to 19.5% in the fourth quarter of the year, and we've seen a market, you know, we've seen a market that's turned dramatically. But as you can imagine, you know, being in our position, we're partly planners, but we're also partly psychologists. And in a lot of cases right now, what we're trying to help people do is kind of take a step out of themselves, you know, remove the emotional decision making process, and look more non-emotionally at the investment plan, at their retirement plan, and to try to make sensible decisions. And, you know, like all of us here, I'm sure if you've ever made a decision when you're emotional, it generally doesn't turn out to be the best decision.
Well, it's certainly not based on the right location of the information. I mean, our gut is a powerful force in helping us make some smart choices. You know, you mentioned the fear of missing out, or, you know, jumping in too late because it looks exciting and you get carried away. You're in an interesting position, aren't you, of having to try to work against the kind of human machinery.
Yeah, the human nature is
right,
opposite
in order to
in
help people
cases.
Make really
Absolutely.
Great, really yeah. great choices.
Yeah.
How much is your practice involved with individuals versus, let's say, larger families and generations? And what are some of the interesting dynamics of that? I mean, I can only imagine that if mom and dad, or, you know, either of them had one outlook and one set of habits and risk tolerance and so on, and now, you know, junior comes along and inherits everything and may have a very different outlook. How are you navigating the generational aspect of wealth?
It's a great question. In our country and our economy in a whole is on kind of the beginning of a paradigm of asset movement and shifts from the baby boomer generation to Gen Xers and Ys and millennials and on down. And how we view money is very different, you know, just from the generations in our experience. Our focus is no different, though. It really comes down to developing a formal written financial plan, much like setting goals. You know, I mean, my dad used to say, if you don't articulate your goals and write them down, they're nothing more than a dream. And we try to do the same thing, is really come back to basics, develop a plan, for what the goal should be, and then follow that plan.
Yeah. You know, wrapping up this little segment within our show, and we'll get on to our other guests and circle back around maybe as some other issues come to light. Obviously, you know, well, we like to say here at Business Radio X that some media leans left, some leans right. We lean business. There's no question that the political environment is certainly part of what's creating emotional charge for a lot of people. At the end of the day, though, you're really in an interesting position in that, you know, the right decision with the right information and the right plan is kind of independent at some level of that frothy layer on top of society and culture and the conversations at the club or in the locker room or on the street or, you know, the moms groups and everywhere where conversations are happening. What's your advice for people looking forward? There's a great deal of uncertainty at some level. And at the same time, that in and of itself is not new. What are you telling folks?
It's a great point. You know, and in my 18 years in doing what I do, I don't know that there's ever been a time or a time that's been more polarized from a political standpoint. And it's certainly driving people to make decisions, maybe not for the best, but it's certainly there. And much like we've been talking about, our goal is to try to help or counsel clients in removing the emotion. You know, and you made a good point is, you know, our goal is to be political agnostic. It's developing a plan. And the reality is, if you look through history and even in the last 15 years to 18 years in my period, there's always been uncertainty, you know, and we tend to go through these waves of political uncertainty, economic uncertainty, yet here we are, right? And we survive and the country continues to, we hope, develop and become stronger. And so again, our goals with our clients is to remove the emotions as much as possible without ignoring the fact that everybody does have beliefs that should be taken into consideration, right?
Sure, and that, we guide their preferences right. And their choices
exactly.
And certain things.
So we can't completely ignore it, and we don't want our clients to ignore it, but we need to try to take a step out to look, you know, more non-emotionally and then develop a plan that does take into consideration our clients' independent and individual needs and feelings around how they think things are going to be.
Well, you know, I'm a social scientist, not an economist, but I do know that markets never go in a straight line.
No.
At least not in the micro level, right? Some days it's up, some days it's down. And it's great that they've got advisors like you in their corner helping them make the right decisions and come up with a great plan. Thank you, Trevor. We'll circle back, hopefully, and have some conversation with our other guests. Mike Brown, let's turn to you, Arizona president of Washington Federal Bank. First of all, tell us a little bit about the bank, about your role, and then what you're seeing as we move into 2019.
Once again, thank you very much for the invitation. Looking forward to this. Washington Federal, it's a 102-year-old bank, which there's not many of us around that have been around that long. The Great Recession, as we just heard Trevor talking about, it put a lot of banks down and down hard. Our particular bank during the recession, we were one of the few banks that still made money. Didn't make as much money, but we still made money, which was very unusual. We have about 230 branches throughout an 8-state footprint, and we were primarily west from Washington down through Texas, and we are not in the state of California, and that is by design. And we're fortunate in the fact that these 8 states we're in, they're all doing pretty well. Washington, Oregon, Utah, Texas, certainly Arizona, New Mexico. So we're pretty happy with where we're at. So any type of ups and downs, as you mentioned, in the marketplace, if it hits one market, we've got the other states to kind of counteract that a little bit. So here in the state, I've got 31 branches, and we range from I've got a couple in Yuma, I'll go up to Sholo, go down as far as Douglas and Nogales. So we've got a lot of big geographical reach for our branches.
Now, tell us a little bit about who you serve. Obviously, at some level, I'm hearing a bank that reaches a lot of different folks in a lot of different communities and a lot of different things. But how would you characterize the bank as a whole? And then some of the branches that you described, certainly we're covering a lot of territory here in Arizona.
A lot of territory. In fact, I've got a lot of managers. They're constantly coming to me going, I've got to go to Yuma. And it's not just a quick trip. It's sometimes an overnight to get everything accomplished. We're a former savings and loan. About 15 years ago, we went on the commercial side. And it's been a very, very good move for the bank. But as a consequence, about 60% of our overall portfolio is still in classic mortgages. And so we've been doing that for a long, 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 long time. We continue to do that. And we do more of the mortgage business here in Arizona in kind of our two primary metro areas of Phoenix and Tucson. The rural markets, we do mortgages out in those rural markets also, but not nearly as much just because it doesn't have the demographics. And then our commercial side of the business, it's been the bright star for the last 15 years for the entire bank. It's the fastest growing segment that we have by far,
right,
in loans and deposits.
Fabulous. And then this gives you a unique perspective on, you know, a lot of what's going on really at kind of the sharp end of the economy, where deposits are being made, loans are being taken, businesses and families are, you know, trusting the bank to help support their financial goals. What are you seeing in general, and what's on your mind is in 2019 in particular?
Well, let me point out something we just initiated literally last week, and it's a particular loan program that I'm really, really taking great pride in from the aspect of the bank. And this came about in 36 hours, but a week ago Monday, the CEO, my boss, called all the regional presidents and said, this is what I want to do. And we put together in 36 hours a government employees relief loan program. And we had a press release on Tuesday afternoon. We initiated on Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. And this is for anybody that's affected by the federal shutdown. And it doesn't have to be a client. And what we're doing is interest-free loans for 90 days. And then hopefully it doesn't take more than 90 days. Who knows? But if it does, we then will convert it to a 5% loan through the rest of the year. And then if people still are having struggling with that, we'll put a 3-year term on it. And these are just classic signature notes. There's no collateral behind it. We're really basing their credit based upon the fact they're a federal employee, and we're running with it. And so it was a very heartwarming product to put together. And I even talked to one of the recipients of the loan last Friday. She's from Safford, worked for one of the prisons. And she and her husband both. And she was telling me how tickled she was to get it. And she said, this morning I woke up for the very first time and my stomach didn't hurt because I could now pay my bills.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, in so many ways, you know, money is not just a tool. It is something that sits at the heart of our emotional response to life. If you think of how many major life events involve either the getting or losing of money, right? Or even in a significant way, you know, a first job, your first paycheck, you got to have a place to put that. You know, there's a way in which banking and the bank has, you know, continued to play a role in the fabric of our everyday life. And a lot of this has moved online, right? Internet banking and apps that allow us to move money around quicker and faster than the old ACH system, which is still groaning under, right, you know, its outdated rules and regulations. And you know, I almost envision somebody somewhere has got a tin can with a string between it and says, okay, move 100. All right, moving 100. You know, it's not really that bad, but it's close. Talk about how a bank like yours been around with 103 years.
102.
102. Heading into 103rd,
correct,
right? Deals with that challenge, right? Technology is always there, and customers' desires change. They want it on their phone. They want it faster. What are you seeing from that perspective?
That's such a great question. Something we're literally trying to tackle almost every day, because if you look back, it wasn't that long ago that you could start doing deposits via your smartphone. It just a few years ago, and the whole concept of it is just mind blowing. And then when I you know, talked to him, like my father, he knows what an ATM is, but you think he's ever going to use one? Not a chance. You know, and so online banking clearly it's what, you know, I'm sure all four of us do on a very, very active basis. So you have to plan for whichever channel your customers or your clients are going to want to use. And to give you a contrast to that, in our rural locations, like in Douglas or Nogales, Yuma, et cetera, we have transaction counts by people walking in the branches to a number that's just shocking. It's far, far, far greater than any metro location we have. Yeah. We'll have, for example, I can think of one branch, they do 4,000 transactions a month. And that's face-to-face with a teller. And
wow.
In my metro locations, I might get 800 to 1,000 a month. Because they're all much more digital.
Correct. You know, I mean, I still remember the passbook from my first account back in the day. And my boys are now 4 and 6. And, you know, when they had some money from grandma, we decided we wanted to take them in somewhere to actually open an account, just to remind them that there's physical dimensions to this. You know, there's people who serve, there's a place your money can go. Of course, it gets converted into zeros and ones at some point somewhere along the way. We'll get to that when they're a little older and they can understand it. But the concept of the bank as a place, is important. How are you within the branches under you or within the company as a whole dealing with that world, customer service, the sense of place? How do you create and sustain that as tastes change?
They certainly do. And I think every bank in the country looks at that on a very frequent basis because the old brick and mortar model is more expensive than the digital model today by a lot. But myself, and I'm sure everybody around this table, if you have a problem, I personally would like to go to the branch and get face-to-face. I don't want to be calling 1-800 or wherever and to try to get my problem solved. I want to, you know, if it's truly an issue that I have, I feel better when I'm talking to somebody about it face-to-face. And we go through that on a daily basis. So we're still focused on branches where there's some banks that are withdrawing, not completely, but dramatically by selling branches, just disbanding them, you know, going more the digital route, which is fine. That's just not our choice. We're gonna take all channels that we can.
And certainly, you know, there's as you say, the balance sheet, it adds up with leases and payroll and, you know, all the other things. And you know, even the cost of, you know, the armored vehicles coming and moving the stuff around, the things that outsiders like me just observe from a distance, everything adds up. And yet, that's what a bank is in some way, in some people's minds. I'm interested in the fact that you're continuing that tradition. Now, what are some of the challenges you're facing? I mean, obviously, you know, we talked a little bit about the political environment. Are there regulatory changes or anything that is really impacting your role? Anything you're excited about? Anything you're worried about? Anything you're bothered about that we should include in the conversation?
Well, in terms of the banking world, the regulatory side, you know, we're probably the most impacted of anybody. We see it daily, literally daily. And the acronyms are BSA and AML, that side of the regulation, which is Bank Secrecy Act and anti-money laundering. Those two areas we're seeing the most focus on by the regulators. And the regulators have turned the banks into kind of the deputies for the sheriffs because they don't have enough sheriffs to control all the bad guys out there. So we have to put in such a tremendous amounts of monies into IT systems that help prevent that because the bad guys are pretty good. They're always learning. They're always, you know, taking it to the next step. So we have to have computer technology to figure out where, as I call it, the whack-a-mole. You know, you hit it once and it pops up somewhere else. You got to be prepared for it. So we're dealing with that literally every day.
You know, it's fascinating, and there's an ongoing conversation about the relationship between an open society and the freedoms we want, and then, of course, the privacy, the protection, the security against threats, and the dynamic relationship between those two. I was just talking this morning with my colleague, Karen Nowicki, who owns another Business Radio X studio here in the Valley, and we were talking about her email system and her server and how she wanted to configure it to do something different. And I said, well, the problem we face here is that the good guys are doing things that look like the same stuff the bad guys is doing. So why these regulations are there, why we have to authenticate these servers, make them talk to each other and all this technical stuff, is because we're doing the same thing a spammer would want to do, which is send mail on behalf of a third party through a fourth party's computer. Now, that's the level of complexity that we're dealing with is nothing compared to the number of points a transaction can be initiated from and how, you know, keeping an eye on the whole thing. Talk to me for a minute about blockchain, something that has emerged in conversation anyway, maybe not in significant reality, as an alternative way of tracking this. Is this something that's on your radar? Is it something you're going to wait for the tech folks to figure out and then you'll roll it out later? Is it relevant?
I probably get that question asked to me more frequently than anything else. And I've kind of taken the attitude, a little bit of a Warren Buffett attitude of, if I don't understand it, I'm not going to do it kind of thing or invest in it.
Yeah.
And I think the banks are kind of taking that attitude of, until we see a little more reality to it and where we can really sink our teeth into it, let's just kind of let it run for a while. And I'll maybe use the analogy back to, you know, doing deposits via your smartphone. I'm sure when that first came out, there was a lot of people going, are you kidding me? And so, you know, it's just something so new, you know, so we're watching it carefully, just not quite ready to jump in full bore yet.
Sure. And, you know, it's interesting the way innovation and adoption work together. You know, you can create the most incredible system, but then not only institutions have to be comfortable with it, but users and customers and everyone else, all the whatever third parties, the regulatory folks, everybody's got to be comfortable with it. So these things take time. I think it's an interesting premise that hasn't yet seen the killer app to go back 30 years of computing, and we'll see what happens. Any other challenges maybe here in the state or nationwide that are showing up in the banking industry, consumer behavior or anything else that has you kind of paying more attention, something you're keeping an eye on?
We're probably watching the shutdown and and as we were talking a little bit earlier, the impact of all that, because it does have a GDP hit, as we're seeing and hearing, and we're kind of watching it pretty carefully. But all in all, I've got to tell you, I'm very much a glasses half full guy, reference to Arizona.
Yes.
I go back to the recession that we had. We were on a trajectory that was unsustainable. It got frothy beyond belief, and it fell just as hard. But now it's nice. It feels good. It's a steady eddy kind of a stair-step growth model, which just feels so much better than what it did the last time.
Yeah. Now, I wasn't here back then. I moved to Arizona 6 years ago. Do you think there's a sense in which the state and the folks in the state can continue, even if things were to get a little bit uncertain at a national level? I mean, is there again, I'm speaking as an outsider. I don't understand enough about this. To what extent are we in a local environment versus something that's linked very much to the other economically?
Well, we look at, for example, one of our business lines is a multifamily type financing, and we do still a lot of it. And the multifamily market here in Arizona continues to be relatively healthy because of a lot of the investors that came in the prior to the recession. They're not here now. Hopefully everybody, and I really think everybody's a lot smarter now in terms of who they're lending to. And as a contrast, you look at markets like, where our home office is, Seattle, where I was just talking to our chief credit officer. He was in town 2 weeks ago, and he mentioned their whole economy is so frothy. I think they had 60 some cranes in the sky, which is somewhat of a economic indicator. He said their median home price, I think, went from 680 and it dropped $140,000 like in a week. Or, a very, very short period of time. That's disturbing. Whereas ours is, here locally, it's once again that nice little steady eddy, little increases, little decreases, but nothing that's going to make us turn our head and go, we have a problem here.
Yeah. Last question for you, Mike. Student loan debt, something that I participate in, unfortunately. I used to tell when I was speaking to elementary school students before I finished the PhD, I used to tell them I'm in the 29th grade. of course, now we know every one of those grades has a cost associated with it. Is this something that as a nation we're going to have to find a more radical solution to this burgeoning balance sheet here? Is it a threat in the sense of somebody who's over leveraged as an individual with their student loan debts, their mortgage, their car payment, et cetera? Is it significant from your point of view, or is it just so much smoke without a lot of fire?
I think it's really significant, and I think has impacted the entire mortgage market, for example, because those millennials, as Trevor was mentioning, they've got a different decision tree to go down, and if they've got a big bunch of student debt, that's layered on top of them, they're going to want either pause before they get that home or that mortgage, or move out of mom and dad's basement, or so it's going to impact them, and they saw what happened in the recession to their parents, and
yes.
So they're faced with the student debt, they're going, I don't want to overlever or stretch. And so I think it's got a pretty big impact. And I don't know what the solution is at this point, because it's a big number.
Right, right. Well, it's certainly something on my mind, and I think it's on a lot of minds. Mike, thanks for being here. Hopefully we can circle back and have some interesting conversation. Timothy Mosier, you're a partner at Quarles & Brady here in Phoenix. You got another cut at this same thing. You specialize in commercial and syndicated real estate, asset-backed securities, healthcare, et cetera. Talk to us a little bit about the work you do, what your company does, and how you serve folks.
I'm a partner at Quarles & Brady. It's a law firm that has over 500 attorneys, 11 offices, 8 states. I'm in the finance services group. I like to call it the financial services team because we work as a team. And we represent, in any given year, over 30 banks, insurance companies, or financial institutions across the country. I have a unique perspective on representing financial services because I started in banking. And actually, I was probably the youngest banker in the country because I started working in a bank at the age of 17. I went in and pitched it to the president of the bank, and he says, well, we don't hire high school kids. What are you talking about? I go, well, give me a shot. So I went to work for them and was with them for 12 years before I went on to law school. And the reason I went to law school was three of us were trying to buy the bank. And we had the financing, but the competing bid exceeded our proposed financing. So we lost it. And I sat there and I said, okay, what do I do now? Working in the bank, I worked with a lot of lawyers. And I said, I think I can do that. So I went into law. So I have basically a 47-year history of finance on the banking side and on the lawyer side. And people talk about the 2008 recession, which was bad. I have a unique perspective because I lived through, on the business side, the 72 recession, the 78/80 recession, the 88/91 recession, and the 2000 recession, and then the 2008 recession. Each one was a little different, but they had a lot of similarities. So it's really interesting on the being a lawyer on the finance side, because we are really the canary in the mine. We can see it coming because we represent so many banks and financial institutions. We can see the challenges that they're experiencing, and it's like, here we go again, you know, it's lining up again. So we're always a leading indicator of the downturn, and we're a leading indicator of the upturn, which is kind of interesting. And so talking to young folks, as we've heard, the millennials, their benchmark is 2008, which was bad, no question. But they really haven't experienced a really gut-wrenching one like 88 and 90, which was just, especially for the Phoenix market, absolutely devastating.
Yeah, that's a fascinating perspective, you know, all the way from the gasoline lines around the block in 72, 73 through to today. Lots of different factors impacting the economy. And as you say, you've got a unique insight. So most of your clients then are institutional.
Correct.
And talk a little bit about the types of clients you serve and what lens that gives you into the details of the economy.
We represent banks, insurance companies, finance companies, and some of our clients are corporations where we represent them as the borrower. So we see it both on the borrower side for their business planning, what they're planning to do, but then we also have the bank's perspective on the lending side, which is kind of unique situation or perspective to be in. It's also interesting because in representing banks in particular now, and to a lesser degree, corporations, the change in the demographics within the financial institutions has changed dramatically. And I'm sure Mike can attest to that. The median age of a loan officer has dropped dramatically in the last 40 years to the point where some of them didn't even experience the 2008 recession. And as Trevor indicated, you know, on the investor side, they think, oh, the market always goes up. And so sometimes with the loan officers, while they have their loan committee, part of our job is to counsel them on giving them a perspective of what can happen if the loan goes bad. Because one thing you never want to do is what I always say is you never want to give the borrower a ticket to the courthouse. Because if you're in the courthouse, you've already lost because it's going to cost you money. So it's really being preventive counseling. Are you sure you want to do that? This is a little better way of doing it. This way we'll avoid that argument that we've seen over the last three recessions. You haven't seen it yet. We say it more diplomatically than that, but you know, you're going to hear these arguments and they go, no, that's stupid. No, it's not.
Right. So you find yourself in that role then of kind of the consigliere or whatever too.
Right. So it's not
I'm
only...
I don't control your business, but I just want you to know the implications of what you're about to do.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. That there are risks in the direction you're going on this issue that, sure, you haven't seen it in the last 10 years, but it's lingering out there and it'll raise its ugly head in the next downturn, which I'm sure all the panelists will agree is coming sometime.
you know, it's fascinating to me the extent to which, you know, the three guests we have in the room here deal with different dimensions of the same matrix, the relationship between people, institutions, and money. Tim, from your perspective, obviously you're trying to advise your clients to make smart decisions, to avoid legal pitfalls. What are some of the challenges you're facing, either with them in general, obviously not in the specifics, but or in the environment in which you're trying to help navigate? What are some of the issues facing your work?
One of them is that comes up quite frequently is the financial institutions have adopted standardized documents, which in the aggregate is good, but sometimes it's a round hole that's trying to fit a square peg, and it doesn't always work. And so getting them to understand that in this fact pattern, which is unique, we need to change it a little bit. Because financial institutions, it's kind of interesting because back when I started in banking, there were actual checks that came back to you in your statement. And banks would actually look at the endorsements. They would actually do due diligence, all that. But now it's cost-benefit analysis. That issue only comes up X number of times, so we're not going to do that. Same with some of the loan documents. That issue only comes up in a small percentage, so our standard documents aren't going to cover absolutely everything. So our role is to help them in understanding that, okay, you have a standard document. We understand that. It works for a lot of stuff. But, you know, in this situation, it doesn't. And that's a challenge for a lot of younger lawyers because they haven't been in the trenches of creative arguments by borrowers, other creditors, bankruptcy, trustees, etc. Because when people are in financial difficulty, creative arguments come very easily to them, very easily.
Well put, well put. You know, it seems to me that, again, you have a fascinating perspective on what's going on. And you pointed to an interesting issue there, which is the mentoring and the developing of younger folks coming up didn't start at 17, but are now, as you were, trying to wrap their head around some of these things and gain that perspective. How do you handle that? You know, it's a very large firm. How do you manage that, and how do you pass on some of that collective wisdom and practice?
Well, fortunately, at Quarles, they have supported me in mentoring the younger lawyers and training them. And a lot of times it's sitting down with what they've drafted and say, well, what about this? And they go, well, what about that? Well, what if the argument is X? Are we covered? Well, why would they make X? And they said, we would win if it was ever litigated. I go, no. The objective here is, sure, to win. The objective is to cut it off so you don't have to experience that. You know, there's in drafting documents, there's a concept called ambiguity. Can a clause be read a couple different ways? If it is, you have to go to the courthouse, and believe it or not, you have to have the judge either decide or a jury decide, is it A or B? And unfortunately, what happens when you take the standardized documents and one shoe fits all, there's going to be inherent ambiguities. And so one of our jobs is to try to anticipate arguments and close the door on those ambiguities. For younger lawyers, that's a challenge. And for younger clients, it's a challenge because they think I've heard this many times, you're over-lawyering it.
Right.
Well, it's going to pay dividends down the road, and they should look at it as a learning experience for themselves that, oh, yeah, that's another way of looking at it. Because some of the younger people look at the document as a script that they cannot deviate from. No, it's a starting point that you then craft to respond to the transaction and the parties that you have before you.
Yeah. How well prepared do you think incoming junior lawyers are? How well did law school prepare them for this? How much of it has always been done the way that you're describing? You know, you get a certain level of education, you hit the ground, you get a position, and that's where the mentoring and learning and professional development really begins.
The young lawyers coming out of law school today are much less ready to perform the tasks that I'm talking about, because law schools now are more open-ended on the required classes. In other words, you can come out of law school now and never study real estate, never study trusts and estates, never study business law. And so we don't need, 10,000 community service lawyers coming out of law school, but you can come out of law school now with almost a general degree as opposed to something that you can come out and actually practice. So for young lawyers, that's why it's very important to get with the right firm coming out, because you need to complete your training. It's almost like an apprenticeship now, more so than it was 30, 40 years ago.
Uh-huh. So you think there's been a significant change?
Yes. Yes. You can raise a business or a uniform commercial code, which is the code that deals with business transactions, checking accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And they may have never had to take a class in that, and they may have not had a question about that in their bar exam. So they come out, and that's like astrophysics question to them.
Yeah.
You get this dazed look. I don't know.
Well, yes. And since Socrates, I suppose, the difference between, what to think and how to think is a very significant difference. And we were really talking about having folks learn how to think and go beyond what's on the paper and what could this mean and what are the implications and whatnot. How does that show up in reality on the court? Can you describe a situation where something like that was a significant issue in your professional work?
I can tell you one lawsuit that I was involved in closer than what I wanted to be. They weren't after me. I was, I'll say, on the good side. But the clerks of the court and the judge asked a question to the lawyers and asked them to brief it and come back the next day with an answer. And this was in federal court. This wasn't a small state's court. This was a federal court. And the question was, what law is there that you cannot tell a lie or provide false information to the Securities and Exchange Commission? Now, I sat there and was like, did we not go to law school? How can you be here and not know that? And questions like that do pop up, and I have to understand that it isn't, they're asking them not because they're not intelligent. They just weren't trained in the area. So that's why a young lawyer requires a lot more training. And as a result of the changes in demographics within the financial institutions, we spend more time counseling and advising the loan officers more than we did 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Any specific questions that you're seeing recur with increasing frequency as we head into the rest of this year? What's on folks' minds?
People are cautiously optimistic. A frequent question, and we have to be careful how we answer it, is what are the other banks doing? They're trying to test the market. Who else is doing this? Who's doing that? Because while we've had a good run here, I think people are beginning to be concerned. Because one of the things about valuations on real estate is every increase in interest rate almost has an automatic reduction in value in real estate. So as the Fed increases the rate, all the commercial real estate may not immediately go down, but it ripples through in the cap rate and the other methodology in valuing that piece of property. So as the interest rates are creeping up, while a value 3 years ago looked good, it has now deteriorated because of the increase in interest rates. So it really is a concern that the institutions are having. What else? What are you hearing?
Right, which you may or may not be at liberty to say in specific cases, of course.
Exactly right. Of course. Exactly right.
This theme of cautious optimism is something that you've all addressed in one way or another. You're optimistic at some level, and there's some caution, some effort to moderate the enthusiasm that you sometimes see. Let's circle back around and talk about that a little bit. Trevor, you've heard the conversation here with Mike and Tim. What are you thinking about as you listen from these other perspectives, from banking, from the legal domain? What's on your mind with regard to your practice?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And thank you, Tim and Mike, for sharing your thoughts. It's, you know, being that we all serve people here in the state of Arizona, and there's so many common themes that I was thinking about as we went through that, the changing demographics and the impact on technology and how we serve our clients, the, you know, being cautiously optimistic. And one of the things my dad always taught me is a little healthy fear and respect for the markets, whether that's real estate or investing in stocks, is a good thing, you know. And oftentimes, and I think even when you think about the last few years, in particular 2017, where the market, stock market I'm talking about, became a little bit frothy, a lot of that fear dissipated and was gone. And, you know, having a respect and whether it be fear or just respect or an understanding of how investments cycle is an important part, I think, of what all of our clients collectively need to keep in mind. Also very interesting, just the changing demographics. I mean, one of the things that our industry has faced with the real challenges is the lack of advisors, new advisors, younger advisors that are coming into the industry. 70, depending on what, you know, report you read, somewhere between 60 and 70% of advisors, licensed financial advisors in the country, are over age 55. And the percentage of new entrants into the business is incredibly low. And a lot of the bigger institutions that used to be good places for people to come out of college and get a job and go through a good college or a training program aren't offering the same type of opportunities. So, you know, it is a, when I think about our practice, that's also a common challenge that we're having is in continuing to bring on younger financial advisors, help train them, mentor them. And like Tim was saying, the experience, although I don't have what Tim had, going through a couple of recessions, you learn a lot of battleground scars, if you will, and you learn a lot. And so we are seeing the same kind of challenge in our industry with young, you know, MBAs and CFPs coming out that just don't have the real world experience, and trying to mentor them through that is a common challenge that we have as well.
Yeah. Mike, cautiously optimistic, fully enthusiastic. What are your thoughts as you listen to these different perspectives?
A little of all of the above. It, you know, I still take the attitude that the glass is half full. However, it's been 10 years since the last recession. And it's just, you know, history will tell you it's coming, yeah. But obviously nobody can peg when. And then you see some areas like, you know, what Trevor's mentioning in the stock market in the fourth quarter of last year. That was a little frightening. And was that the big correction that was going to drive everything else? So lots of bouncing around right now versus a year ago when I felt pretty confident, you know, with the stock market, et cetera. But now it's like, you know, if we start seeing some more corrections, it's going to affect real estate here. It's going to affect everything here. So everybody's, you know, once again, cautiously optimistic, like you stated. But I, for Arizona's perspective, it feels a heck of a lot better than it did on the last one.
Yeah. You know, this issue of the training and developing of young professionals in your areas has certainly been part of this conversation. Talk to me about Arizona's place nationwide here. How is it, Mike, for you at the level of the banks and the branches and whatnot to attract the kind of talent you want? Is that something you're working on? Talk about the people development part.
The people development has been a real big focus of the bank. And then I've taken a couple other specific issues and run with it myself. But our training and development department has really been enhanced over the last 12 months, I think because it had to, because our industry used to be a great area for training, and it really kind of fell down. And so we're picking it back up. And what I'm doing here on a local basis, and I go back to, I've been now here for 14 years and came from Denver, and I was a ski instructor, and I loved teaching. And I kind of was almost a pay it forward kind of a concept whereby I was a pretty good skier, so I wanted other teach a few people how to get a little bit better. And I've taken that same kind of teaching attitude with our, you know, kind of our kids, if you will. And I call them, I formed a club, and I call it Mike's Young Turks Club. And so those shooting stars that I can recognize. I personally get involved with them and I try to work with them and make them ready for that next position. And then I've been able to promote many of them. And there's even a couple I've purposely held back whereby that, you know, they're getting all anxious and, you know, kind of this age that, you know, they want to jump into senior management like in a day after tomorrow. I will tell them, said, okay, I've got my eyes on you, obviously. And this next position, and say one comes open, I'll let them know this is good for you, or maybe the best counsel I can give, you're not quite ready. Let's wait for the right one because I don't want to put you in a position to fail. And that's worked on a couple, and they kind of upped their game a little bit. So when the next one came around, I was able to do something with them. So it's been fun working with them, and I've even had a couple say they're going to get letter jackets and the whole bid for the club, but it's been fun.
I love that. That's great. Tim, you've got your own approach to mentoring young folks. Any standout examples in your mind of the kind of situations where you need to put them in there, trial by fire or development? I really like the example of the ski coach here. Is that something you can relate to? Maybe not on the slopes, but in another area?
Yeah, I could think of two in particular. One is that law firms, unfortunately, the modeling has moved away from having finance lawyers spend time in the bankruptcy group and in the commercial litigation group to understand the flip side of a new deal. And fortunately, I came up through the time when that was just the norm. Likewise, in the banks, it used to be you could not become a loan officer, a senior loan officer, until you spent some time in special credits, which is the workout bankruptcy area. So you saw the other side, because you need to see both sides. That's one that I was going to mention. The second is history always repeats itself, many times though in slightly different clothing. Let me give you an example. In Arizona, there was a lot of fraud in the 80s in real estate development, in particular on the valuation side. And a lot of deals failed because of creative appraisal methodology. And I won't bore everyone with the details. But fast forward 12 years, there was an oil and gas business that failed miserably. And I'm sure you've all heard of it. Enron. Enron, on a lot of their valuations, merely repackaged what the developers were using in Arizona in the 80s and applied it to different assets. But it was the same thing. And it was good for me because I worked on the downturn here. So I got exposed to that and understood this really doesn't make any sense. How did this become the norm? So when I was approached about working on the Enron case, I looked at it and said, I know what they're doing. And people looked at me, what do you mean you know what they're doing? Well, as a result of it, I was one of the principal structured finance lawyers for the Unsecured Creditors Committee for 2 years, which was great experience. But it was a situation where I saw the downturn and it was a bad methodology that just got repackaged. Now, the question today is, what's been repackaged and is going to expose itself in 2019 and 2020. Very seldom are they new. They just repackage them some way.
Fascinating stuff. This has been a delightful conversation. I'd love to just do a quick round. Robin, any final words? A lot of folks listen to Business Radio X, small business owners, career professionals, executives, solopreneurs, you know, the whole gamut. From your point of view, what's something you want folks to know or think or do as they move forward? Let's just come back over to Trevor and we'll start with you.
Oh, thank you. There's so many things that come to mind, but I think that in my profession and what we really try to do is just planning. And Mike and Tim can probably relate to this in their own business aspects, but often what we find is people really don't dig in and plan until they're upon the moment, whatever that moment should be. And I think, you know, so what I think about is just plan. Take the time to remove yourself from your business, if you're a business operator, your family, and to sit back and say, what are our financial goals? How should we be structuring our investments and our saving plans? How should we be structuring ourselves legally? How should we do our banking? All these things should be integrated together. And if you need help, and in many cases, especially with our business owners, they do, find someone that you believe you can partner with, you know, whether it's someone like myself or these other great Tim and Mike's group to help them identify the proper way to structure themselves and really plan, get ahead of it, you know. And my experience is that if people will do that, they're going to be far better prepared for these eventual downturns when they do come, and they're going to be better prepared for the expansionary times as well.
That's great. Trevor Wild with Wild Wealth Management Group, thanks so much for being here. How can folks find you and learn more about what you do?
Thank you. You can find us at www.wildwealthmanagementgroup.com or you can give us a call at the office at 480-361-6203.
That's great. And Wild with an E.
Wild with an E, yes.
Wild
thank you.
Wealth Management Group.
Yes.
Mike Brown, Washington Federal Bank, final thoughts. What are you seeing? What do you want folks to think or do, or any final words you'd like to share?
I mean, the only final words, and I don't want to make it sound like a commercial, but it's this government relief program that we're doing. I really am, I've got great pride in this because this is truly helping, and these are folks that aren't our customers or our clients, and we're helping them. And it's such a great, great feeling. So those that have people that are affected by this, because you know, and those that are affected are clearly pawns. They just don't have the cash right now. And my wife and I were literally talking about this last night, and I was keeping her updated, and she goes, you know, it reminds me of the time when we were first married and we were kind of that paycheck to paycheck type of a family, if you will, because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, you've got student debt, you've got all these other things, and those paychecks are important. And so I'm just having so much fun with this and talking to these ultimate customers. In the first 3 days we did this, we had 405 loans we gave out to those affected individuals. And that's just one of those feel good kind of things. So I'm having fun with this because it does feel good.
Absolutely. And that is a fabulous program. Thank you for sharing that. Mike Brown, Arizona President of Washington Federal Bank. Where do people learn about the bank and about that specific program?
Just give me a call directly and I'll route it from there. And my direct number is 480-607-4848.
Great. Thanks for being with us. Tim Moser, final words?
I've been receiving frequently over the last couple of years is, we're okay with this contract, aren't we? We're protected, aren't we? And I have to tell them, I've always lived by a rule. You don't do a deal with someone unless you're willing to do it without the contract. The contract gives you one thing, and that's a ticket to the courthouse. And if you have to use that ticket, you've already lost. So I think it's more important now than ever to be not only cautiously optimistic, but cautiously, cautiously optimistic.
That's great. Timothy Moser, partner at Quarles & Brady here in Phoenix. Where do folks learn about your firm and your services?
Probably the best thing I can do is spell Quarles. Quarles. Quarles & Brady. And again, I'm Tim Moser, and my direct line is 602-229-5262. And thank you for having me.
Thank you all for being here. Gentlemen, it's been a great conversation. I appreciate the work you're doing. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.